content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. First today, the longest suicide note in American history. This was written by Anne Applebaum. Last year, a team of American diplomats from the State Department's Global Engagement Center traveled to 24 countries and signed a series of memoranda, along with their counterparts in places as varied as Italy, Australia, and Ivory Coast. They agreed to jointly expose malicious and deceptive online campaigns originating in Russia, China, and Iran. This past September, the Trump administration terminated these agreements. The center's former head, James Rubin, called this decision a unilateral act of disarmament, and no wonder. In effect, the United States was declaring that it would no longer oppose Russian influence campaigns, Chinese manipulation of local politics, or Iranian extremist recruitment drives. Nor would the American government use any resources to help anyone else to do so either. The recent publication of the Trump administration's new national security strategy showed that this decision was no accident. Unilateral disarmament is now official policy because, despite its name, this national security strategy is not really a strategy document. It is a suicide note. If the ideas within it are really used to shape policy, then U.S. influence in the world will rapidly disappear, and America's ability to defend itself and its allies will diminish. The consequences will be economic as well as political, and they will be felt by all Americans. Before explaining, I should acknowledge the curious features of this document, which seems, like the Bible, to have several different authors. Some of them use boastful, aggressive language. America must remain, quote, the world's strongest, richest, most powerful country for decades to come, end quote. And some of them prefer euphemism and illusion. Sometimes these different authors contradict one another, proposing to work with allies on one page and to undermine allies on the next. The views expressed in the document do not represent those of the entire U.S. government, the entire Republican Party, or even the entire Trump administration. The most noteworthy elements seem to have come from a particular ideological faction, one that now dominates foreign policy thinking in this administration and may well dominate others in the future. The one genuinely new, truly radical element in this faction's thinking is its absolute refusal to acknowledge the existence of enemies or to name any countries that might wish America ill. This is a major departure from the first Trump administration. The 2017 National Security Strategy spoke of creating an alliance against North Korea. It noted that Russia is using subversive measures to weaken the credibility of America's commitment to Europe, undermine transatlantic unity, and weaken European institutions and governments. And observed that China is using economic inducements and penalties, influence operations, and implied military threats to bully others. The 2017 Trump policy team also observed a geopolitical competition between free and repressive visions of world order. The second Trump administration can no longer identify any specific countries that might wish to harm to the United States, or any specific actions they might be taking to do harm. A decade's worth of Russia cyber warfare, political intervention, and information war inside the United States goes unmentioned. Russian acts of sabotage across Europe, Russian support for brutal regimes across the Sahel region of Africa, and of course Russia's invasion of Ukraine aren't important either. None of these Russian acts of aggression gets a mention except for the war in Ukraine, which is described solely as a concern for Europeans. Even more strangely, China appears not as a geopolitical competitor, but largely as a trading rival. It's as if Chinese hacking and cyber war did not exist, as if China were not seeking to collect data or infiltrate the software that controls U.S. infrastructure. China's propaganda campaigns and business deals in Africa and Latin America, which could squeeze out American rivals, don't seem to matter much either. The new document makes only a vague allusion to a Chinese economic presence in Latin America and to a Chinese threat to Taiwan. When discussing this latter possibility, the authors drop their swaggering language about American power and slip into bureaucratese. The United States does not support any unilateral change to the status quo in the Taiwan Strait. Other rivals and other potential sources of conflict get no mention at all. North Korea has disappeared. Iran is described as, quote, greatly weakened, end quote. Islamist terrorism is no longer worth mentioning. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is still thorny, but thanks to President Donald Trump, progress toward a more permanent peace has been made. Hamas will soon fade away. The American troops who are still fighting in Somalia and Syria, and in some cases dying, are ignored, as if they didn't exist at all. But if America has no rivals and expects no conflicts, then neither the military, nor the State Department, nor the CIA, nor the Counterintelligence Division of the FBI need to make any special preparations to defend Americans from them. The document reflects the assumption that and instead directs the U.S. national security apparatus to think about control over our borders, natural disasters, unfair trading practices, job destruction and deindustrialization, and other threats to trade. Fentanyl gets a mention. So, rather strangely, do propaganda, influence operations, and other forms of cultural subversion. Although there is no indication of who might be using propaganda and cultural subversion against us, or how it might be countered, especially because the Trump administration has completely dismantled all of the institutions designed to do so. But what if this document was not written for the people and institutions that think about national security at all? Maybe it was written instead for a highly ideological domestic audience, including the audience in the Oval Office. The authors have included ludicrous but now familiar language about Trump having ended many wars, a set of claims as absurd and fanciful as his FIFA Peace Prize. The authors also go out of their way to dismiss all past American foreign policy strategies, presumably including those pursued by the first Trump administration, as if only this administration, under this near-octogenarian president, can see the world clearly. Finally, although they do not name any states that might threaten America, the authors do focus on one enemy ideology. It is not Chinese communism, Russian autocracy, or Islamic extremism, but rather European liberal democracy. This is what this radical faction really fears. People who talk about transparency, accountability, civil rights, and the rule of law. Not coincidentally, these are the same people whom the MAGA ideologues hate and dislike at home. The same people who are fighting to prevent MAGA from redefining the United States as a white ethnostate, who oppose the corruption of America's democratic institutions, and who object when Trump's friends, family, and tech allies redirect U.S. foreign policy to benefit their private interests. European and American liberal democracy is so dangerous to their project, in fact, that the MAGA ideologues seem to be planning to undermine it. They don't want to meddle in anyone's internal politics anywhere else on the planet. We seek good relations and peaceful commercial relations with the nations of the world without imposing on them democratic or other social change. The glaring exception to this rule is Europe. Here, it is now American policy to, quote, help Europe correct its current trajectory, end quote, language that implies that the U.S. will intervene to do so. According to reporting in reporting by Defense One, an earlier version of the National Security Strategy said that U.S. foreign policy should even seek to support illiberal forces in at least four countries, Hungary, Poland, Italy, and Austria, to persuade them to leave the European Union. For all four, this would be an economic catastrophe. For the rest of the continent, this would be a security catastrophe because a damaged EU would struggle to counter Russian hybrid warfare and Chinese economic pressure. If the Union breaks up, there would also be a European Commission, no longer be a European Commission, capable of regulating American tech companies, and perhaps that is the point. At the same time, the document's authors seem to derive their hatred of Europe from a series of false perceptions, or perhaps from a form of projection. The authors fear, for example, that certain NATO members will become majority non-European very soon. Because they are presumably not talking about non-European Turkey and Canada, the clear implication is that countries such as France and Germany have so much immigration from outside Europe that they will be majority non-white. And yet, it is the United States, not Europe, that is far more likely to become majority-minority in the coming years. The security strategy also talks bizarrely about Europe being on the verge of civilizational erasure, which is not language used by many European politicians, even those in far-right parties. Carl Bildt, the former Swedish prime minister and foreign minister, has called the sentiment to the right of the extreme right. In multiple indices, after all, health, happiness, standard of living, European countries regularly rank higher than the United States. Compared with Americans, Europeans live longer, are less likely to be living on the streets, and are less likely to die in mass shootings. The only possible conclusion, the authors of this document don't know much about Europe, or don't care to find out. Living in a fantasy world, they are blind to real dangers. They invent fictional threats. Their information comes from conspiracist websites and random accounts on X. And if they use these fictions to run policy, then all kinds of disasters could await us. Will our military really stop working with allies with whom we have cooperated for decades? Will the FBI stop looking for Russian and Chinese spies? Earlier this month, the Justice Department announced that it was taking action against two Russian state-sponsored cybercriminal groups that, among other things, targeted American industrial infrastructure. But if our real enemy is civilizational erasure in Europe, then surely we should redirect resources away from this kind of secondary problem and focus them on the threat posed by the British Labour Party or the German Christian Democrats. One is tempted to laugh at these kinds of ideas, to express incredulity, or to turn away. But similar conspiracist thinking has already done real damage to real institutions. Elon Musk believed distorted or completely false stories about USAID that he read on his own X platform. As a result, he destroyed the entire organization so rapidly and so thoughtlessly that tens or even hundreds of thousands of people may die as a result. At the State Department, Darren Beatty, the Undersecretary for Public Diplomacy, has repeatedly and falsely stated that the Global Engagement Center was censoring Americans, a fantasy that he encountered on the Internet, and he continues to repeat without proof. As a result, he destroyed that organization and ended its international negotiations. He is now conducting an internal departmental witch hunt, trying to find, or perhaps invent, post hoc evidence for his conspiracist ideas. Some elements of this story are familiar. Americans have overestimated, underestimated, or misunderstood their rivals before. And when they do, they make terrible mistakes. In 2003, many American analysts sincerely thought that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. During the Cold War, many analysts believed that the Soviet Union was stronger and less fragile than it proved to be. But I am not sure whether there has ever been a moment like this one, when the American government's most prominent foreign policy theorists have transferred their domestic obsessions to the outside world, projecting their own fears onto others. As a result, they are likely to misunderstand who could challenge, threaten, or even damage the United States in the near future. Their fantasy world endangers us all. Our second story, What I Wish I'd Known When I Was Younger, written by Arthur C. Brooks. On his 70th birthday in 1905, Mark Twain gave a speech about the secret to successful aging. If 70 doesn't sound aged to you, bear in mind that because of the high infant mortality rates, the average life expectancy for someone born before 1850 was less than 40. "I have achieved my 70 years in the usual way," he declared, according to an account in the New York Times, "by sticking strictly to a scheme of life which would kill anybody else." The maxim he offered was this: "We can't reach old age by another man's road." Typical for Twain, this was solid folk wisdom wrapped in a joke. The secret to a long and happy life is clearly not smoking, drinking, or carousing. But he's correct that there is no plug-and-play formula that works for everyone. Within obvious parameters, each of us should experiment with different ideas and specific ways of living, a proposition I have previously discussed. Some people are at their healthiest on a vegetarian diet. Others will be so by eating Mediterranean. Some are happiest living in a big metropolis, such as New York City or Los Angeles. Others are living their best life out in the country. These details aside, however, a few general habits do matter. I won't detain you with the health and wellness stuff that you might hear from your doctor. Lay off the smokes and go for a walk, for God's sake. I want instead to call your attention to certain patterns of behavior that are not so obvious, but that help explain why old people tend to be happier than young adults. The sooner you can learn and adopt these rules for good living, the sooner you can enjoy their fruits. No question you will come across some grouchy, unhappy old people, but on average in the United States, older adults score significantly higher in well-being than younger adults. Older people experience lower psychological distress and negative effect, and more frequent positive effect. I have also written before about how older folks tend to enjoy positive changes to their personality. Agreeableness and conscientiousness rise as we age. Neuroticism falls. What explains this pattern is not immediately apparent. Without a doubt, acquired wisdom plays a role. Older people have more life data and make fewer errors. But three particular patterns of behavior that old people display do matter a great deal. The first involves social networks. Early in life, you are probably encouraged to develop a wide range of friendships with different kinds of people for the sake of your happiness. This was good advice insofar as you learn new ways of thinking and living from people outside your typical social circles. But it doesn't mean that you need to expend special effort maintaining links with lots of people with whom you have superficial ties. This would just fill your free time with unrewarding interactions. Yet precisely this sort of broad but thin acquaintance characterizes the networks of many young adults. Older people selectively narrow their social circles to focus on the individuals with whom they share common passions, experience positive emotions, and derive satisfaction. The casual associates who don't make the cut are left behind. This might sound selfish, but people actually become more altruistic as they age. the second pattern of behavior that raises older people's happiness compared with that of young people. In a 2021 survey of research on self-reported altruism and observed charitable behavior, four psychologists found that 14 of the 16 studies they reviewed revealed that older adults are more focused on others than younger ones. In one especially ingenious demonstration of this finding, researchers asked adults of differing ages to clasp a handheld grip strength device called a dynamometer and squeeze it with a high level of effort in order to obtain rewards for themselves or others. Younger adults gripped harder than older adults for self-rewards. Older adults gripped harder than the younger adults to gain rewards for others. The third pattern involves how older people react to difficult events in life. As a person ages, they usually get better at both avoiding and dealing with life stress. One 2023 longitudinal study involving nearly 3,000 adults, ages 25 to 74, found that 70-year-olds felt stress on 40% fewer days than 25-year-olds did. Part of this is because the elders exposed themselves less to stressful events, but it was also because they were less reactive to stressful situations. Some of this is surely down to life circumstances. Retiring 70-somethings no longer have demanding jobs. But another factor is that when old people encounter a stressful situation, they tend simply to shrug it off. Whether to respond to a challenging event might not seem voluntary, but in fact it can be. And when the stress is unavoidable, the elderly simply react less by caring less. As I was writing this essay, one experience came to mind that reinforced the points above, involving a two-day meeting that I'd attended in Rome some 25 years ago for a large international charity. The conference convened a small group of well-being specialists, some very junior, as I was at the time, some much older and more famous. Among the latter was a 60-year-old woman of global stature in the field. Feeling honored to be in her company, I paid close attention to her behavior. At the time, it seemed a bit strange. Now it does not. She had flown long haul through the night to attend the meeting without compensation and participated fully in every session. But when it came to the lavish dinner party held on the last night of the conference, which to me was a great perk, she walked into the bistro and declared, "This place is too loud," and left. This remarkable woman was exhibiting all three happiness patterns. She was spending time professionally with people who shared her passion for a cause. She was making a personal effort and donating her considerable expertise. And she was saying no to something that wasn't worth the stress and sacrifice to her. At 36, I was amazed that she'd pass on the party. Today, I follow her example. I will go to considerable personal effort to serve causes that I care about, and I will discuss matters of spiritual depth, or scientific importance for hours on end. But small talk in a noisy bar? No chance. So what follows are three general rules I learned from older people that lead to higher well-being. 1. Go deep or go home. I try to ensure that my social relationships, those that are voluntary and involve discretionary time, focus only on facets of life that matter: love, faith, philosophy, virtue, culture, aesthetics. I don't want to talk about my beach vacation or yours unless a major epiphany occurred as the tide came in. 2. Serve more. A unique channel of well-being is serving others in causes I care about. This can mean giving money and time, of course, but it also entails regularly subjecting my work to a values test. Does each activity primarily edify and uplift others? 3. Care less. I think back to the things that kept me awake as a younger man. This conflict at work, that worry about money, and shake my head. Now when something is bothering me or threatens to stress me out, I ask myself whether the issue is likely to be bothering me in a week's time. If the answer is no, I try to get a head start right then on not caring. True to his craft as a satirist, Twain preferred to mock the whole business of elders dispensing counsel to youngsters, as he did in his 1882 essay, Advice to Youth. If a person offend you, and you are in doubt as to whether it was intentional or not, do not resort to extreme measures. Simply watch your chance and hit him with a brick. I strongly suspect, however, that Twain followed better rules than this by the time he was 70. Closing his birthday remarks, the old riverboat pilot said he had laid a course toward the sinking sun with a contented heart, no doubt by following the happy, if not quite so funny, principles above. Today's third story, A Lesson in False Limits, by Sally Jenkins. Few professionals suffer more from ageism than athletes. Heaven forfend an NFL star or Olympian becoming 40-ish on the field of play. That's known as staying too long or tainting their legacy. Fans and commentators seem to want athletes to retire before they lose the luster of their prime and start looking knee sore. An expectation that, judging by recent exploits by the skier Lindsey Vonn and the quarterback Philip Rivers, has cheated audiences out of who knows how many gladdening third acts. What a corrective to such nonsense Vonn is. Last Friday, at the age of 41 and on a partially replaced right knee, she sprayed the snow of St. Moritz at 70 miles an hour in the downhill event to become the oldest skier, woman or man, to ever win a World Cup race. Her last World Cup victory had come 7 years earlier, or as she later said wryly after her win, just a couple of days. The shock of Vonn's resurgence had not yet worn off when, 2 days later, the 44-year-old Rivers jogged gingerly onto the field as an emergency starter for the injury-thinned Indianapolis Colts. He is literally a grandpa, has an easy chair double chin, hadn't thrown a pro pass since his retirement in 2021. The Colts' opponents, the Seattle Seahawks, were rated as 14-point favorites. A hand-lettered sign held up by the Seahawks fans read, "For every Rivers sack, AARP gets a donation." Yet Rivers threw a touchdown pass, which he celebrated with a double pump of his fist and an air kick, and led his team to a near victory. Vonn and Rivers unretired in different circumstances, but they both saw an opening to compete again, and something adventurous in them said, why not? They were guided not by a desire for perfection of their prime, but instead by an exploratory curiosity. The easiest way to eliminate all the things that could go bad is to stay home, Rivers said, and the only way to find out can you still do it is to go try. I'm sorry I had to severely edit that last article because we've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org.